Hello, everybody. Happy New Year to everyone. All right. So we got starting off the new year with a pretty decent, I think, pretty interesting topic. I don't know where we all stand on it, which I think is going to be interesting to find out. We're talking, of course, about the death penalty, and it's appropriate. We actually planned this back last summer, not knowing that this would be the same week, basically, that, you know, we know that Dylann Roof was recently sentenced to death. So it's sort of apropos to be talking about it today. The timing is good. So it's actually something that's current and in our news right now. We're missing Rabbi Romberg, which is a noticeable loss, I'm sure, right? We even left a chair for him, right? We can pretend he's here, right? Yeah. So unfortunately, he's not here with us. So that's a loss, but we know where he's doing. I think he's in New York, you said? Broadway. Okay. Okay, wow. So, let me just have us go down the line, and we'll start with Father Dustin, and he's our guest panelist today, and I'll let him introduce himself.
Good afternoon. My name is Father Dustin Fedden. I am a priest at the Cathedral of the Sacred Heart in Pensacola, Florida, although I really have kind of spent considerable amount of time here in Tallahassee. Was raised in the area, went to Florida State University, received a doctorate in religious studies there about 3 or 4 years ago, and have been serving as a priest for about 6 or 7 months. But before that, and well, actually over the past couple of years, and kind of, I guess, relevant to the topic today, I've been spending considerable amount of time serving those on death row and solitary confinement at Florida State Prison and Union Correctional over the past three and a half years or so. So this is a topic that has become very much a kind of a priority for me and for the work that I've been doing in this area. So thank you.
I'm Josh Hall. I'm the associate pastor here at First Baptist Church, and on behalf of First Baptist, welcome and glad to have all y'all here today.
Okay. Hi, Happy New Year. I'm Betsy Willett-Zierden, and I'm the pastor at Good Samaritan United Methodist Church over in the Southwood area.
Hello, everyone. I'm Derek McGee, and I'm the pastor of Bible-Based Church on the south side of Tallahassee. And as Father Tim said, Happy New Year.
I'm Father Tim, Co-Cathedral of St. Thomas More. So our first question I want to ask, and I'll start, we'll just go down the line, I think, is sort of, maybe what do our respective faith traditions teach in regards to capital punishment, in regards to the death penalty? And also, where do I stand with that? So if, you know, yeah. You know, how do I feel about that personally? Yeah.
All right. So straight into the deep end. Yeah. All right. I don't know who I'm being asked to represent here. We'll go General Baptist here or Southern Baptist. There is, I think, within the Baptist tradition, there is the support of the death penalty as being grounded in Scripture, though there are plenty of folks who identify as Baptists who would disagree with the death penalty and would be opposed to it, or may nuance and say, yes, in principle, it's taught in Scripture. However, in this society or in this current judicial system, you know, there are misgivings about it. And then I'll say, for me personally, I believe that the death penalty is upheld in Scripture. And so for me personally, if that's what we're asking, yes, I do support the death penalty for those who commit premeditated acts of murder and heinous crimes. You know, and granted, there are qualifiers to that. But as far as death penalty per se, yes, I support it.
From the Catholic tradition, as it stands right now, and the Catholic tradition is constantly in development and its moral teachings and understanding of social and political issues that face any particular generation. At this moment, and really over the past, probably since post-Vatican II, since the 1950s, 1960s, the Church has become much more suspect about the morality of the death penalty and capital punishment. Considering this, one, the Catholic Church believes that all life is sacred, by virtue of the fact that all of life is created by a loving God who freely chose to bring all existence into existence, all of life into existence. So there's the absolute sacredness of life. And right now the Church sees that really the only possibility that we can justify capital punishment or the execution of an individual is if they are a danger to the public good or to innocent lives. In other words, do we as developing nations have the capacity to put into some form of solitary protected management a criminal from, you know, from society? And we in the Catholic Church believe that most nations, most developing nations, have the capacity to apprehend and to imprison those who might be in danger or might cause any harm to innocent lives. And so for that reason, the Church sees there being no moral justification for the death penalty in most cases. It is not considered an intrinsic evil in the case of, like, for example, abortion or euthanasia, but it is hardly imaginable within the teachings of the Church that there would be any justification for the execution of any individual.
So you agree with...
I'm a Catholic priest.
Okay. Hello?
I'll just clarify a little bit about what Father Dustin just said. I mean, we have... We generally, you could say today that the Church's position on it has evolved through time, it developed through time, but ultimately, at this given stage, it's not something that we would say maybe that we're anti-death penalty, we're against the death penalty. However, that's not an absolute, that there are occasionally potential incidents where it would be necessary to execute somebody. And this is different, by the way. This is not, there's a distinction here between this and, let's say, war. What's going on in combat or a combatant or something. This is, we're talking really about criminals and being able to capture them and putting them in prison and so on.
So I'm a United Methodist, which means we're divided on the issue. I think that United Methodists have the freedom to think different things. I personally believe that I've been called into the ministry of reconciliation, a ministry of forgiveness, a ministry of restoration. And so I am of the opinion that we should not kill anyone, even someone that we might think deserves to die, because we don't deserve to kill. That's my perspective. But also I believe that it's possible that a person on death row may have a transformed life in the end. And for those reasons, I just don't feel like any human being has the right to declare a sentence on someone else's life.
So I struggle. I really struggle with this. I actually agree with what Josh was saying and what Betsy was saying. I struggle because I think of situations like Dylann Roof, for example, where individuals are in a church service and they get gunned down, and then I don't understand. It's hard for me to would understand giving a person life without the possibility of parole when families are dead. The same point, I'm a believer of reconciliation. I'm a believer of the grace of Jesus Christ and things of that nature. But I do struggle with it, struggle in a major way in that regard. What Josh said from a doctrine standpoint, I agree with. But personally, and I think I struggle with it because, you know, my flesh says this person deserves to die. And so I struggle with that. And again, I look at Dylann Roof, for example, and not because the act happened in a church, just a matter of it happened and things of that nature. But I do struggle with the death penalty. You know, here in Florida now, the Supreme Court passed down a judgment in that regard. And so I just struggle with the whole thing. So I'm actually intrigued by the conversation, and I'm gonna be very, very frank in most things I'm gonna say, but I do struggle with it.
Okay, I'd like to, since we have Father Dustin here, he came all the way over here, and he has a vast experience of dealing, working on death. Can you share just personally a little bit of what you've experienced and why you've come to, not just because of the Church's teachings, but why you agree with it or why you believe what you believe in regards to the death penalty?
Yeah, I think you know, it's some of what Pastor Betsy had already mentioned, which is this hope that that really every single human being has the capacity to change, to be reconciled, to become, you know, whether we want to think of it particularly within the kind of Judeo-Christian tradition language, redeemed. And just my conversations with so many different men on death row, I can tell you now, they are no different for the most part than you and I. Actually, there is a great difference for a majority of the men have grown up in abject poverty, extraordinary situations of being deprived of any meaningful familial life, of family structures, found themselves addicted to drugs, in many ways have kind of bore the consequences of a very materialist culture that they have grown up in and that they have lived in. And you hearing the lives, and this doesn't take away from the heinous acts of what it means to take another life, but as a thoughtful, enlightened society, I hope, we have the recognition that there are stories to be told, there are stories to be heard. And one gentleman in particular from Liberty City, actually a good number of men that I have met on death row in solitary confinement, come from basically a three-block radius in Liberty City, Miami, which any of you that know the area, it is, could be a pretty dark place for someone to be raised. Pretty miserable living situation. But anyways, this one gentleman, Tavares, told me, he said, most of the men on the row made a really awful decision that they are paying for with the rest of their life. And he kind of challenged me, do you believe that it is possible for people to change, for people to learn, for people to not necessarily be the person that they were? And then I thought of myself. I thought, what if the case was that I was defined by my worst act? What if everyone saw me as a liar, as a perhaps cheater, as one who, say, gossips, and that became my identity? That was how you, and that's how the rest of society, and that's how our law saw me. And for many of these men, this is the rest of their lives, up to the point to where hopefully it isn't the case that they'll be strapped onto a gurney or placed into a chair. But this is now defined the rest of their lives. And if we as a Judeo-Christian and beyond, all the various different religious traditions have understandings of reconciliation, of grace, of forgiveness, if we as a society cannot forgive those who have committed heinous acts, I think we have to ask ourselves, how can we expect to be forgiven for the acts that we have committed, for the laws that we have transgressed, every single one of us? And so for me, I feel like hearing the lives, hearing the stories, never excusing the crimes that they've committed, but understanding that Tavares is Tavares who committed murder, but that he is a human being created by a loving God that I believe deserves understanding and mercy. And that's a challenge. And I'm not saying that that's easy. It's not easy for the lives of the families of the victims. But I believe that as a society that I would hope, is based on justice and mercy, that's where we have to find ourselves, grappling with those questions of the difficulty, as Pastor Betsy mentioned, of reconciliation.
You're getting ready to fire.
Yeah, I am, because I hear you, Father. I guess my struggle is, and I guess my question would be then, is it a discussion on the law pertaining to the death penalty or a personal fundamental belief of the death penalty? Because I believe in what I hear what you're saying, but take it from the other end where you have that mother or father whose child is the victim of Tavares's crime. And it's one thing for me going in as clergy and talking about reconciliation. Another thing when you have that parent who's without that child, and now we're trying to tell them and that they need to work through the process of reconciliation. I struggle with that.
I don't believe that you have to be reconciled to your murderer, the person that murdered your child.
But forgiveness. I'm talking about from a forgiveness standpoint.
Well, forgiveness is a personal issue. So if the family, as we've seen families do in the past, forgives the people that killed their child, then that's something amazing in their life, and it's fruitful. But when I say I believe in restoration, reconciliation, it doesn't mean this family with the person who murdered their child. Although we've had a panel that has done that very thing.
True.
And it's life-giving to everyone in that case.
But agreed. But isn't reconciliation, part of reconciliation is me realizing I need to be reconciled.
Well, I was speaking of reconciling with God. Spending time.
I got that clarity. Okay.
Yeah.
Tim, can I hop in?
Yeah,
please. I think one thing with this discussion, and I knew that this would come up, is we got to define our terms. And so what do we mean when we say forgiveness? Yeah. Okay, because parents in the room, raise your hand. Okay, child says they're sorry. You say you forgive them. No consequences, right? What do we call that? Where I come from, we call that bad parenting.
Yeah, death row is a consequence.
No. So I'm saying the point is, so we have to be able to distinguish what do we mean when we say forgive. Okay, if someone, let's make it simple. Someone steals $100 and they say they're sorry. Do you just move on, or is there a debt owed, even apart from the forgiveness? And so I think sometimes we conflate personal forgiveness, God's forgiveness, and the role of government. And I think what we sometimes miss in this discussion is that God has instituted and ordained government to have a particular role. And when we talk about the justice system, it's in the title. The point is justice. Okay, the point is that justice be done. We can't now, the point of the justice system is not behavior modification. That might come from it, but we can't let the tail wag the dog. And this is to Derek's point, the point of the justice system is that justice be done. And so we can't beg the question here and assume that, well, death penalty is inherently unjust. That is the question, is it just to kill one who has committed a premeditated act, willful to kill another?
And I think the question of forgiveness thank you for clarifying that. It is important to know. I certainly wouldn't be arguing, and I don't think the Catholic Church would be arguing, and I don't think many other from other different traditions that are against the death penalty would argue that forgiveness means a blank slate and that there's no debt owed. But it does mean that when you use the parenting analogy, that when you forgive your son or your daughter, or when you punish your son or daughter, that you give them a punishment, but that you're not going to see them and identify them as a liar or as a cheater or as a thief for the rest of their life. When we hand out death sentences, most cases, it's case closed. You are now, there's no other question or possibility for justice to work other than that justice is now entirely punitive, that it is entirely punishment based rather than an understanding of the possibility of what might it mean to correct, right, the child, to teach the child so that the child comes to an understanding that what they did was wrong, and then they will pay the consequences. But is that what is operative with death sentences? No, I think at the end, a death sentence is entirely punitive, and for that reason, I think, cruel and inhumane.
But the purpose, and this is where we go back to the question of justice, is because murder is a singularly unique crime in all of culture and society and in scripture. It is a singularly unique crime because, and the same reason that you value human life is because of the Imago Dei, because this is Genesis 9, because we are created in the image of God, life therefore is sacred, and that the crime of murder is ultimately not even against the person whose life was taken. It is killing the creator in effigy.
Right.
It is showing contempt for the creator, and therefore there is a justice to be served there that is separate and apart from stealing or other things where, yes, we do try to shape and correct, especially as a parent. But murder is a singularly unique crime.
So to use biblical references and stories, we have King David, a very famous murderer who had a heart after God's own heart. And the scripture seems to imply, although interpretation is open to some degree, that he lost a child, and that was the consequence, right? We have the Apostle Paul, who killed many, 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 many people, and God called him to bring the gospel to the Gentiles. So I struggle with you, both of you, saying that there's biblical support for the death sentence. I mean, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. I mean, mm-hmm. they do that in other countries, but we find it to be abhorrent.
To use both of your examples, David, when confronted with his sin in Numbers, and I quote, "This man deserves to die." Paul, when he stood accused in Acts 25, his objection wasn't that the death penalty is inherently wrong. He said, "If I've done something deserving of death, then let me die. But if not," and so his appeal wasn't that the death penalty is wrong. His appeal was it's wrong to kill someone who's innocent. So that was his opportunity. Jesus himself, before Pilate, did not object to the death penalty. He actually affirmed to Pilate, "You wouldn't have this authority to kill me if it hadn't been given to you by whom? By God."
My point is to go along with the father here, is that the Apostle Paul was not a murderer in his entire definition. You see what I'm saying?
I do, but I don't see how that changes.
Let me just say, when we talk about to say that this man deserves death, David says, right? I am, at least personally, very grateful that I haven't gotten everything that I deserve. You know, I recently went to, and I could say it, yeah, I deserve this, and I deserve that, and I do, God's witness. And I went to the prison recently, or jail recently, to visit someone, and this was a person whose life had just completely come apart. And it was one of the most tragic things I had seen. And it was in the news and so on, but I went and saw this man, and the basic, I think most people's reaction from reading the comments in the news was that this man deserved to be hung from buildings and so on and so forth. But what I saw in this person was myself. And that whatever the mystery of his life and whatever it is, I don't have whatever struggle he has. I just don't. And it's not because of any choices I've made. I just haven't been burdened with this struggle or temptation. I have my own. But if I had been in his shoes, it could have been me sitting on the other side of the glass. In a world of despair and hurt and pain and everything he's going through. And so I think about that, you know, and how do I then, does he deserve some kind of punishment? Is there some kind of, what then is the goal of our justice system? And so for me, at least with the death penalty, and I want to ask this to kind of keep to more the root and the value of what we're talking about. When is it moral and when is it ethical for a government to kill somebody?
So let me, Father Tishra,
is it because we're angry at them? Is it because they deserve it? Is it because it's when does it become morally okay? Even if it was a deterrent, would it be okay? Because I don't care about the practicals, but when is it morally okay for the government to murder somebody?
Well, see, here's why I think we're confusing this. I believe, because I think we're having two discussions in one, where death penalty from a moral perspective and from a government perspective. And the reality of it all is if I go out and commit a murder, I know by the law of government that the death penalty is an option. I know that. Now, there are some who have mental health issues. I understand that. But those of us I know that. And so anytime you're pleading down, you're pleading because you want to get that off the table. But you know that's an option. My struggle is more of a moral struggle. Because I understand what Father is saying about the Tavares example and, you know, does have another chance. But think about those individuals who have been given that penalty, who are not remorseful, who are insubordinate, who are rebellious, who find no reason to apologize for what they've done wrong. And you have those that are out there. I understand. And I would agree with going and ministering to them and trying to get them there. But here's the reality of it all. Number one is We're a melting pot. Everyone in here does not share the same faith that I have. Number one. But number two, and most importantly, is I don't believe you can remove out those who are left with the infliction, because now the victim is gone. So now the victor becomes the victim. I don't think that that's how it's set up. In addition to that, the justice system is designed that way. I'm not a believer that government can resolve our problems. I am not. However, on the books, it is a penalty. Death penalty is a penalty out there. This governor who's in office now, and I may be off on some numbers. If you look at his predecessor, our one governor here now has done way more death certificate warrant, whatever the phrase is, those of you who are lawyers, we've done way more under Governor Scott than his predecessors. And I understand everybody has an opinion about that, but here's the reality of it all. There are people who have been on death penalty, death row for years, years and years. And the law still allows them to appeal when they come up. They get to appeal and they get to burn out several levels of appeals before they even go to the chair. So they have rights. But the person who lost their life, they have no rights because they're dead. They were murdered. It wasn't an innocent act. Somebody did this to them. And I understand. And so that's my struggle, is counseling or ministering to the one who committed the crime and yet reminding them that what you did, somebody else lost in this.
Sure.
That's
sure.
My struggle.
Sure. And no, that's a great point, Derek. Just two things that I think. One, I think it's important to understand, at least from the social teachings of the Catholic Church, there's not to be a distinction between morality and government. That we do believe that government has a responsibility for the common good, for moral and social goods, that it's not just blind or justice devoid of any sense of what is ethical, what is the nature of the human person. And that the government does bear responsibilities of enacting laws that are just and that are good. I mean, this is we have many prophets in our own nation that testify to this reality and that are beacons of light to the justice systems to kind of keep in mind what does it mean to be a just and moral and effective government. With regards to the fact that they committed a crime, absolutely a heinous crime, and the life of the victim do not have rights anymore because rights at least in this life. I think it's also important though, right there, with that mentality, then execution, capital punishment, the death penalty becomes nothing more than a mode of vengeance. And do we want to imitate the lives of violent criminals? Do we want our just, moral, and good government to be imitating the same act, essentially, of what that criminal committed in terms of, and when I say act, I mean the taking of life. And I would say we can do better. And I would say that I think that we do not have to prop up this artificial, and by the way, the death penalty in the Bible, vastly different, entirely different to be understood. Adulterers would have been executed if we're still using the capital punishment of the Old Testament. Moses himself was another murderer who would have been executed. So the notion of a biblical notion of the death penalty, I think, needs a lot more discussion. There's a lot more ambiguity there. But I do beg the question that I think, what does it mean for our government to be effective, to be sure, but also moral and good?
Well, and regarding effectiveness, I mean, we know that the death penalty does not deter murder. We know that it costs a whole lot of money for the government, for us, taxpayers, to sentence someone to death. It'd be better that they get life imprisonment as far as the cost to you and I that pay taxes. So that's not a positive. So I don't know that it's effective in any way, shape, or form. I mean, it is an effective mode of vengeance, and it may make the family. And listen, if I had my child murdered, I know that the first thing I would want to do would be strangle someone. I know I have a mother tiger inside. I could scratch your eyes out if you mess with my babies. But when I get more cool-headed and I take it apart, I realize, no, this is not something that I want our moral government to condone. And the good news is that I think we killed 18 less people this year. Was it 18? There's a total of 33 that were...
I believe one in the year of 2016. Sheila, there's a few in here that would know the exact number, but I believe one.
But to that, the question, because this comes up a lot with deterrence, I don't think it's relevant. Because, again, to go back to my point, the question is one of justice, regardless of whether it deters. I mean, let's just be honest and address this. If losing your life is not going to deter you from crime, what punishment is? And are we going to rule out every other punishment because it's not effective? I don't think so. So it's an argument that proves too much to say that it doesn't deter, therefore it's not effective, therefore we shouldn't do it. Well, then charging them $1,000 isn't going to deter them, so we shouldn't do that either. So I don't see how that is persuasive.
You're right, and that's why it's not, in my mind at least, and for us, you know, getting into the particulars of whether or not, I've heard arguments like, well, Iran and North Korea and Saudi Arabia do this, and therefore, well, we don't want to be aligned with them, and that has nothing to do with it. I don't care if the whole world does it. What difference? The question is not whether it's effective, cost-effective. I don't care if it was the best deterrent. Is it morally okay? That's the question. And I think that's what, as clergy, what we have to ask. Politicians can deal. They had a bill a couple of years ago, one of the representatives put forth, and the response in the committee from the committee chair was, well, if it's that inefficient, we'll just speed it up. We'll start killing them faster. I don't think that was her intention and what she was trying to accomplish. But that's a good response if that's what we're talking about. What is the value? And what is it? Again, I go back to the original question. When is it okay? Because we're saying that murder is wrong. So then when is it okay for the government to murder another human being?
Well, I can answer it. And even to push back a little bit on your comment about the biblical description of the death penalty, without getting into a lesson on ancient Near Eastern literature, there's a case to be made that many of the, I think there are 21 capital offenses in the Mosaic Law, okay? And if you look at other ancient Near Eastern law codes, Hammurabi's Code and others, many scholars believe that this was meant to be more rhetorical than literal. It's not the way that we apply statutory law. So, for example, if you take a physician, I think under Hammurabi's Code, and if he did something that resulted in the death of a patient, his hand was to be cut off. Well, who would want to be a physician? Nobody. That's not sustainable. And even in the Mosaic Law, if you build a house such that, you know, someone died, the house collapses. Well, who wants to be a builder? Nobody. It was meant to convey the value of the life. And what was implicit in that and made explicit later is that a ransom was available. In most cases, a ransom. So with adultery and others, a ransom was available. And the reason we know this is when you go to Numbers 35:31, makes explicit that for the one who has committed, so to answer your question, the one who has committed premeditated murder, who chose to hate his neighbor in his heart and chose to do this, no ransom is available. So in other words, for some of these other crimes, a ransom may be available, but when it comes to someone who chose to willingly kill his neighbor, that no ransom would be available. His life is forfeit. His life is required.
I would like just to, does anyone try to answer my question?
Though? I wish Jack was.
That was me answering your question though, right?
I wish Jack was here though.
Said, when should we kill? And I said,
when is it okay for the government to kill?
That was my answer. When you've got premeditated murder. That was my answer. When you've got premeditated murder.
Murder becomes okay.
It's not the same. To clarify something, there's some moral confusion here when we want to equivocate between the death of an innocent victim and the right, the death of the murderer. I'm sorry, but that's just, that is morally weak language to say we're doing the same thing. No, we're not. That's the reason that I don't believe abortion is the same thing as the death penalty.
This is maybe unfair, but would you be willing to inject it yourself? Pull the plug, would you be willing to do that?
If that was my role in government and society, then yes.
You'd be okay. Though.
But not just out of like, oh, I want to get my jollies for doing that, okay? But I'm saying like if that's my role in society, because if I do believe that God has ordained that to be a function of government, somebody's got to do it in the same way that someone's got to take out the trash and someone's got to, you know, rule the city and everything else, whether that's me or somebody else, it is a proper function of society.
Okay. No, I'm glad you answered. Anybody else? Okay. Come on. This is good. All right, hold on. 1 second. Can I just respond to one thing? We can talk about ancient, what Babylonians did and Hammurabi and all this. But to me, one of the quintessential texts of mercy and forgiveness in the New Testament, if I'm a Christian, I mean, that holds pride of place, especially the Gospels, is the scene in the Gospel of John, where the woman is caught in the very act of adultery, and they're about to stone her. And the words of Jesus are not about what does she deserve, or what is the function of the state, or what is justice here, but instead, let the person who's committed no sin cast the first stone. And when they all walk away, he says, is there no one here to condemn you? No one, sir. Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. And to me, that is very different than no ransom or paying a ransom or any of that. To me, I mean, that is quintessentially, that's mercy. And that's forgiveness.
But Jesus upholds the law, though. Like, that's what we sometimes miss. We see the mercy in that, but Jesus doesn't say it is wrong. It would be, guys, stop. I'm God. It would be wrong to kill her. Instead, he recognizes that a grave injustice is about to take place because it's obvious she's been set up and the other person has been released. But he upholds the law because the way he upholds the law is he says, what does the law require? Two witnesses. And so after he confronts the crowd, there are no witnesses left. So Jesus is able to uphold the law. He says in Matthew 5, He hasn't come to abolish the law. He's come to fulfill it. He upholds the law, but he also ensures justice because this was clearly something meant to either entrap her, entrap him, or punish her.
I'll just say really quick. I think, these are all excellent points to be made. Again, I would like to hope that we can kind of imagine the possibility of the fact that we don't have to kill people for justice. Just to think about that, the possibility that justice can mean far more than the taking of life, whether it's guilty life or innocent life, the taking of life, that we are perhaps more than that. And that to me is a hope that I think is personally, as a Catholic Christian, a Christian hope. But we can talk about that later. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Elke Long. I appreciate the time and I appreciate the discussion. What's been bothering me pretty much from the beginning, we're talking about consequences and you're saying, oh, well, you know, the victim's family. How would you minister to the offender's family? I mean, he had a mom and dad, right? I mean, you know that many families visit on death row. How would you minister to them? What would you tell them? Or to make it more personal, my brother-in-law is on death row since 83. What would you tell my 8-year-old son and my 11-year-old daughter when he gets put on the gurney in a couple months? He's out of appeals. You know, his time could be any time. What would you say to somebody? Because the consequence, where does the consequence stop? Where does it stop? Does killing him bring that person back? This is really, and you know, you are all from the faith community. What the government does is a whole different ballgame, and we could go on and on and on how unjust the justice system is. But from a moral perspective, what would you tell the offender's family? It's right because he killed. That's why a mom and a dad is going to lose. That's why my 8-year-old and my 11-year-old are going to have to witness the execution of their uncle that committed a crime in 1983, who's been in solitary confinement since 1983. He has lost his mom. He has lost his dad. He has no one visiting him. And you're going to minister to my children? It's just, it blows me away that the church is taking this kind of stand. The church, the moral responsibility, because you have a moral responsibility to minister to all of us, just even to my children.
Don't just say the church. You have to be...
if that was directed at me, I'll be the guy to respond. It's a tragedy. We're not going to have a neat, easy answer to this. You know, one thing that's been implied in here is this comes down to your view of humanity, okay? And you either view man as an autonomous moral agent, or you view man as a machine. And what's implied when you have a mechanistic view of humanity, it's this view of, if I'm not taking a shot at Tim, but it's going to sound that way. If I had been in the same circumstance, I would have done the same thing. Well, that's a mechanistic view of humanity because that says external forces are going to determine what I do. But if we recognize that each person is an autonomous moral being who has the freedom to make choices, well, then there are consequences to those choices. And we live in a fallen, broken world that we are all sinful, and there are different consequences for our different sins. I can't say anything to fix the tragedy of that situation, but I'm here to tell you as well, there's no penalty that's going to bring the victim back. So again, it doesn't, to argue the death penalty doesn't bring the victim back, well, neither does life in prison. So do we discard life in prison because that won't bring the victim back? No, it's a question of justice.
Let me just be clear. I said I may have acted in the same way.
I didn't mean to imply you'd be a murderer, Tim.
I believe in freedom, but I would just, not being in the person's shoes, can I, you know.
Okay, so we actually have a lot of questions.
I have a hard time not speeding, all right? Every day I'm like, I'm not going to get angry at these people on the road, you know, and I still do, you know.
So I'm going to ask everyone to keep their questions fairly short because it looks like we have a lot, so we can get through some.
Thank you. Exceedingly important discussion. One dimension that might help to further inform this discussion is really the term or concept of justice has been mentioned many times. I had the privilege of serving as counsel to Governor Lawton Childs, and for the first two of several years on staff, I handled clemency, which included review of capital cases to determine whether warrants would be issued. When there were executions, I was on the phone with the execution chamber and the attorney general and the courts. As a result of that, it was abundantly clear that the justice that you're referring to or the process leading to the concept of justice was broken. It's unreliable. Many variables. I served on the ABA Florida Death Penalty Assessment Team that put out a report that did not reach the question of whether there should be capital punishment, but it explored the extent to which there was reliable process of justice. So I think what your focus is on the beliefs, attitudes, values, religion, ethics, morality. To some extent, you talked about efficacy, but I think so this may not be central to this conversation, but I think it's absolutely important to take into consideration that the process itself is highly suspect.
And question. Well, and may, if I may just say, just a quick number, over 150 men, maybe women as well, have been exonerated and deemed innocent. So the begs the question, have we executed an innocent life, and where is the justice there? So,
I just need to add one thing, because my former district superintendent, Dr. Bob Gibbs over there, reminded me that in the United Methodist Church and the Book of Social Principles, the United Methodist Church stands against the death penalty.
Okay, question here.
I doubt that I need a microphone, but I just had one statement to make and then a question. And the statement would be, I think a big piece of the puzzle that we're leaving out is this cannot be settled with a blanket response. And we're leaving out motivation. Even in the example of if a kid stole $100, do you let him go just because he feels bad? My question is, why did you steal that $100? Was it to help somebody? Was it to feed somebody? Or were you just being bad? And I am torn down the middle with this issue because I am capable of murder. And I know that because I'm a mom. And not the kid, although some days he pushes me. If somebody hurt that kid, I could kill them. I am capable of it, and I did not realize that until 4 years ago. But at the same time, another distinction that needs to be made on a spiritual level that sometimes we don't make is there's a difference between sin and evil. There are sociopaths that are unable to be reconciled because they do not know the emotions, empathy, and feelings and concern that we know. I would place them in evil. Sin nature we're all capable of. I have my my undergrad degree in criminology. I've been around criminals or inmates, and I've never been so repulsed and disgusted and just dirty feeling as I did on death row in Stark. And I've been in medium and minimum and felt great. So there's evil and there's sin. There's a distinction, I think.
Go ahead. Thank you. I'd like to bring a pragmatic point of view here. It's based on my 14 years as a parole and probation officer and being paid to associate with known felons in that capacity, including numerous ones who had taken a human life. I think if you look at history, you'll find, pardon me, I think you would find that throughout history, no matter how heinous the crime, no matter how strong the public opinion, if a person is sentenced to life in prison, at some time down the road, there is a better than 50-50 chance that some paroling authority is going to turn that individual out loose on society again. I personally would be against the death penalty, provided that we had a 100% assurance that a life imprisonment sentence meant a life imprisonment sentence, and the individual would not be turned back onto society to victimize them, with the one exception being we could have hearings related to new evidence to prove possible innocence of the original crime. Thank you.
Excuse me. Here's another question.
I have a quick comment, and there is a question here, which I'll get to very quickly. If Rabbi Romberg were here, I'm not going to speak for him, but I feel fairly certain, having studied Talmud with him, that he would be pointing out that when we review the Bible, when we review the Old Testament, we do so not in a vacuum, but also in the context of the history that came out of that, particularly in the Talmud, and the summary of that, which I'll say very, very briefly, is that we need to be very, very careful in how we apply the death penalty. Yes, it's in the Scripture. Yes, it's in the Old Testament. But I believe the comment in the Talmud was that if there was a court that was at one time in 100, actually one time in 70, applied the death penalty, that was a harsh court. And the question is why? And this, my suggestion coming out of Micah, and this is my question. We've talked about vengeance. We've talked about justice. We haven't talked about humility. And if one of the things that's required to us is to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with God, then my suggestion, and it's my question, doesn't the concept of walking humbly with God mean that we should err on the side of not taking life? We should err on the side of whether it's merciful, whether there's forgiveness, whether there's intent, put all that aside. To me, humbly means we don't try to pretend we're God. And so my answer to Tim's question, I'm not clergy, but you asked the question several times. I'll be the first one who answers it this way. And personally, I've been on both sides of the death penalty in my life in terms of being totally for, totally against it. But my question now in the context of humility for you, in the context of Micah, is the answer to your question, when is it okay for government to kill people? The answer should be never.
Thank you.
To give you guys a chance to catch up, you want to say anything, and we've been peppering you with.
We have another question here.
Okay. When I was 21 years old, my family became a victim of a mass murder, one of the worst in California, 3 children and a mother. This person was serial. They had done it repeatedly. It was not that. And at the time, you know, being like they call me liberal California, I was totally against death penalty, and that really questions your faith and stuff. And then right away, it was like when you hear all the facts and all the stuff that this person kept continuously being let out, you're like thinking, yes, he needs a death penalty. But as I matured and grew spiritually and stuff, I realized, who are we to judge? It doesn't matter whether your faith is Catholicism or Baptist or whatever. Isn't that what we're taught all the way through? Who are we to judge and to take a life? And that I've also learned through this process is that 30 years later, it doesn't, by taking his life, he's still on death row, by taking his life wouldn't have made, in the end, it doesn't make anything right or better. And in the end, I feel like he should not be executed because it goes against my faith in the sense of
it's not for us as humans to determine who is to be have their life taken.
Hello, I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I feel something that wasn't directly addressed, but that I like that I heard from the group was, like, deterrence doesn't matter, in the sense that you want to identify specifically what justice is. I think retribution is the interesting thing. What I thought was interesting was, okay, if you kill people who kill, isn't that the same thing? And I agree that it's not. That, you know, if the government kills people that are murderers, that's not exactly equivalent. But I wanted to pose that perhaps that's worse. It's worse for the government to do that in the sense that, well, if we're just focusing on, you know, killing people, what's the difference between different types of killing? We understand meditation is a big factor that separates the degrees, and that's the difference between manslaughter. Like, manslaughter is an accident, second degree is passion, and first degree is planned out. When you look at capital punishment, it's tantamount to the most serious usage of premeditated killing of another person. You have somebody who's there for an upwards of 18 years on average that is being placed in, you know, terrible conditions. I heard of solitary confinement, and there's something called like a death row phenomenon or a death row syndrome that, you know, we can see people psychologically traumatized, kind of torturous and cruel and conditions. So when we look at everyday instances of, I am so devastated that somebody commits an atrocious act, and we can say the act is even worse because it's premeditated, you can follow that same line of reasoning to apply to capital punishment and say, if it's horrible for, and the people here that, you know, personally impacted, you know, my condolences, what little solace that may offer me. When you look at that person, you say it's terrible that they even plan to do that sort of thing. You can extend that to say it's terrible that the government could plan for decades to do that to people. And I was wondering, at least, because I know that's, you know.
Thank you.
Idea,
that's a good question. It's a good point. Thank you.
I know we're going to run out of time. I know some people are saying government should never do it. Let me just say this. Government is made up of people. And the people don't get in government by themselves. We put them in government. And so, ladies and gentlemen, while you may not agree with it, and I told you at the beginning, I struggle with this, here's the reality of it all. The reality of it all is that we play a role in who makes up government. And most people who are running for office, they're very proud of, I'm firm on this, I'm firm on this, I believe in Second Amendment rights, so on and so forth. And guess what? That rallies people behind their positioning. Whether government is right or wrong, the fact of the matter is, it's on the books. And it is one of the punishments handed down. Now, I'm going to say this, it was mentioned earlier, I'm a father of two, also pastor of church. I would love to be able to say if one of my children were murdered, that my first thought would be to pray for the victim and forgive them. I would not lie to you and say that, because at the end of the day, one of my children was just killed by someone else. And I'm going to have a hard time speaking to that person and saying, I forgive you, without first going through the process of my rage. Now, it's one thing, as he mentioned, for manslaughter, that was accidental. But when you premeditate, when you contemplate and you go forth with this action, I have a hard time with the belief that I was just now say, you know what, I'm sorry, I forgive you, you're good to go. The question was asked about how to fix the family. I don't know, like as Josh was mentioning, I can't bring them back. But here's the reality of it all, ladies and gentlemen. We also, the question I want to ask, and she's now gone, is what is the uncle saying to the niece and the nephew? Because you also have to own up to what you've done. And anything that we do wrong, even with sin, we have to own up to what we've done. And I'm not perfect in no stretch of the imagination. The reality of it all is that it's on the books and it's one of the punishments. And as a father, I would have a hard time if I went to court and the judge told the person who killed my child that I'm going to give you just, you know, 30 years to life. It's not going to be enough for me. And that's my struggle, ladies and gentlemen. And I believe in the word of God, but it is my struggle. And it's a moral struggle. I understand that. But it's my struggle.
Super fast to his question. I think he's confused premeditation with due process. The point of the murderer premeditating is his plan is to commit an act of evil. The point of the government, even with the delays, is trying to ensure due process so that injustice will not take place. Even though the system's not perfect, that's the reason for the delay, is to ensure to pursue justice, not to pursue evil.
I'm going to get the, it's at one, we always end promptly, but y'all can come up here and, but I got to tell you, last year I said, we need to talk about the death bound. You know, it's boring. Hey, this is pretty good, I think, right? We should do it again. So I want to thank Dustin, but let me just close it just with this thought. And oftentimes we hear on one argument or the other is, how would I feel if this happened to me or something? And I was very moved by some of the victims' families in the Charleston shooting. Getting up there, and some are, obviously very angry, and of course they should be. And then some people offering their forgiveness and their mercy and opposing the death penalty for Dylann Roof. I thought it was very moving. And so the question is, which, is it just because I would be angry if I had a child and I lost, does that make that right? My feelings are wrong a lot. My desires are wrong a lot. And they're not always aligned with God. And that's why I need His mercy. In closing, there's a saint in the Catholic Church who was murdered in the late 1800s, early 1900s, St. Maria Goretti. Young girl, 11 I think she was, 9 years old, attempted rape by a man who stabbed her multiple times. She didn't die immediately. They took her to the hospital, and on her deathbed, she forgave her assailant, her murder. The man went to prison, and because he was 17, they didn't have death penalty. I don't believe there. At least he was treated somewhat as a minor. He was not repentant. He had no problem with what he had done, and it took years before he had a vision, at least. He had a vision of Maria Goretti coming to him in a dream and forgiving him. And he had this conversion experience, and when he was released from prison, he went to the mother and asked forgiveness. They went to Mass together, and he was present at her canonization. He spent the rest of his life in a monastery in a humble way, taking care of a garden. He had to live with his sin for the rest of his life, but there was redemption there. And I hear that story, and I hear that this man who murdered this woman was present at the canonization. And I think, to me, that's goodness, and that's beauty. I think that's what we all long for, whether we can get there or not with all these other issues, I don't know. But to me, that's a shining example of the possibility for restoration and redemption in the face of evil, in the face of murder. I want to thank Dustin, Father Dustin, for being here. Can we give him a round of applause? And thanks to all my panelists. Excellent as always. And thank you all for being here. God bless you all. Take care.